Paul,
they can't eat.
You're up. House Committee on Revenue for February 19, 2018 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4091. Mazin, go ahead and give us the short explanation, and then we'll hear from Representative Evans, please.
The shortest explanation possible, Mr. Chair, is that this bill attempts to create public or state-owned cash depository or slash between two quotes a bank, and I think the representative probably would have this whole explanation of how it works or it's proposed to work.
Okay, thank you. Is Don Morris here? Why don't you come up? We only have the two of you signed up, so you might as well sit together.
Sounds good.
Right. Anyone else on this bill, on House Bill 4091? All right. Representative Evans, thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for holding this hearing. I'll try to be as brief as I can. I did submit a letter that outlined most of the major components, and with great respect to the staff, I'd like to clarify this is not a bank. I'll be very clear, this is not a bank.
Okay.
So what it is really a solution to what at current is, in my mind, a clear and present danger to the public safety of the state of Oregon and its citizens, and here's what I mean. Right now, the state of Oregon, because the voters have decided so, marijuana is a legal industry. The cannabis industry is legal. However, the United States Attorney General specifically, but the federal government in general, has some prohibitions in place that are actually moving in the opposite direction from where the federal government was moving prior to the Trump administration. My concern about this is not the politics of marijuana one way or the other. I'm somebody of my generation who has honestly never actually had marijuana, but I know that the cannabis industry itself is providing a number of jobs and has, at least from what I can tell, an emergent growth market. The citizens have made it legal, so it's my job as a legislator, I think it's our jobs, to try to find a way to make it as safe, as sustainable, as certain as possible. And right now, there are large sums of money that are being used in what is essentially a cash-only business because the federal government's not allowing the industry to utilize the banks and the credit unions. So this is a very specific, very tightly written proposal to establish a depository corporation. In the letter, I emphasize, would not have the power for checking accounts, would not have the power for savings accounts, would not have the power for credit cards, would not have the power for loans for individuals. It would, in fact, be a safe and secure storage facility where rates, a board would be determined, a corporation board oversight would determine the rate schedule, and money for short and long-term deposit would be basically paid by the person who is having the money stored. I want to emphasize, in banking world, you sometimes focus on the idea of a deposit and people get generating revenue because the bank gets to use the money. This is the opposite of that. The person who chooses to deposit the money is, in fact, paying a fee for the safe, safe and secure storage of the money. And theoretically, at least, I can't speak for the board because it's not created, but if the board was put in place, it would determine the amount of money or percentage for every withdrawal and every deposit. It is a way to ensure the safe transport, the safe storage of what is essentially large sums of cash moving around the state of Oregon. And I want to emphasize this from a public safety perspective. If you look at the prohibition era of the United States, one of the reasons organized crime got as much power out of that era as they did wasn't because they were necessarily the ones running the drugs or the booze. It was because they actually had the money at the time to offer off the books, and they actually gained a lot of money because there was no official banking world for the folks who were making illegal alcohol to be able to utilize. In this particular case, the citizens of Oregon have said, for the state of Oregon, the cannabis industry is legitimate. We have to have something in place or we risk even more violence. We risk the likelihood of other businesses, not legitimate, taking advantage of folks who are simply trying to do a legal business in the state of Oregon. This is a very tightly written bill. It is not trying to create a public bank. That's a good discussion, but for a different day. This is specifically to try to provide safety to the industry. Any questions?
Thank you. Questions for Representative Evans? Yes, Representative Reschke, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Evans, for bringing this. So explain to me how this works. So as a grower of marijuana, I sell, I get a lot of cash. I need to put it somewhere. So I'd put it into this corporation. And then can I move that to a bank, or is it just how does the flow of money go?
Thank you, Chair Bernhardt, Representative Reschke. Right now, so the way it is envisioned to work is if you have a business, you deposit the money. After you withdraw the money, you can do with whatever you want. There is no electronic connection, however, from this corporation to any financial institution. It would be a standalone entity. Whereas most banks and credit unions have electronic relationships, this specifically the only, it would be created inside the Department of the Treasury, and there could be, and this is an emphasis on could, there could be some type of electronic transfer related to the Department of Revenue so people could pay their taxes, but it is not linked into any other bank or any other financial institution.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Stay right there in case there are others later. Yes, sir. State your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you for hearing me, Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Donald Morse, and I'm here in support of House Bill 4091. I represent the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. We are a trade organization for the industry. We've been around approximately 5 years. We have taken part in developing legislation and the rules for the industry over the last 5 years. We work very closely with OHA and OLCC. Our mission is safe access in a socially responsible manner. And while that applies when we wrote it towards cannabis, we're now looking at the problem that the industry faces with not having a place to put all the money. I know people that bury it out back, that put it behind drywall in their homes. I know one person that stores upwards of $100,000 in the freezer down in his basement. It's crazy what we have to do in order to protect the money that we have legally earned here in the state of Oregon. Mm. And it does
all that cold cash?
Yes, sir.
That's hilarious.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yeah, that's probably where the expression comes from.
So this is what poses the problem for us of what do we do with the cash that we do not need outside of operating expenses? You know, what do we do with our profits and where do we put it? We also have a huge problem in paying our taxes. And as the senator said, this could be one way to help alleviate that. It would be best for us to perhaps every 2 weeks send an armored car to this depository, and then our tax money would be there amongst the rest of our money, and taxes could be paid from that to the Department of Revenue. You know, this past year or so alone, we've done over $100 million in tax revenue. You may recall from the news, to draw attention to what's happening, I drove down here with Tobias Reed one time to pay the taxes for my own dispensary. Something needs to be done for the sake of safety between now and a change in federal policy. And we see any move forward as being a good step. You know, we're glad to hear that you are talking about this problem at least, and we hope that you would, you know, follow through and pass this bill. It is a good first step. And I think it could save lives in the long run.
Thank you. Questions?
Chair Barnard,
Evans, please.
If I could close with one thing, I just want to say I appreciate the comments made. I also want to emphasize really the largest argument you will likely hear of opposition is this would be somehow enabling people to use the money in a criminal way. And I would argue that that's happening already if it is happening. What this provides is actually
an account-based accounting system, meaning that everybody who would deposit would have an account number and a tracking system. It would not be aligned to the Social Security numbers because that obviously would provide a connect to the federal banking and credit union functions. But an account system that provides some level of record keeping, I would suggest to the body, is better than no system at all, and that you can't prevent every misuse of a system. But in this particular case, it's a first step because it looks, at least on the horizon, that there's not going to be any structural change on the federal perspective for at least 2 to 3 years. And that's a lot of time for people to get hurt that don't need to be hurt.
Sure is. Yes. Representative Fillion, please.
Thank you, Chair. All right. Representative, I have a couple of questions. And I've read the bill, and I've read your letter, and I appreciate your letter because it clarifies a few things. But most importantly, so what we're essentially creating is, for lack of a better term, a Brinks truck service and a vault. Because if someone, a retailer, submits X amount of money, it'll stay in that vault as X amount of money with the surcharges to hold it. But it will not be converted to an electronic form. It will not be converted to a deposit slip. And it will not be FDIC insured. It will not be anything else. It'll just be we're building you a vault to store your money. And if you want it, you come back and you take it back in cash. Is that a correct assessment?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Finley, thank you for the question. Yes, in fact, and the reason is, and again, I try to be very sensitive to the idea of the public enterprise getting into private spaces. But if a private entity were to do that right now, they theoretically could be convicted because of involvement in an illicit federal perspective crime. So it effectively is just what you talked about, with one asterisk. And the asterisk is that the revenues generated, if they exceed operating expenses, by statute would go into business development for economic development purposes for the use of the public. I don't anticipate large volumes of that, but the idea is that really when the federal government decides something can't happen, the only entity that has any legal ability to stand up to the federal government, I would say, is the state itself. Because any private entity or nonprofit entity probably would get crosswise with some federal law here or there.
So a quick follow-up. I read in the language it talked about general fund impacts, and it's hard to determine what that would be. I mean, without an organizational structure, without and all of the real estate and all the other structures, it's hard to make an estimation of what those costs would be. Would you envision that the percent of charge for storage would offset those, so in the long term there would be zero budget impacts?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Finley, my long-term goal, if this works appropriately and we have them staged in places that make most sense, and I'll get that in a minute, is that it would actually be not just pay for itself, but there would be a moderate level of economic development revenue over the long term. Now, but here's what I want to emphasize. We would have to place these facilities near where the cash is being generated, which would mean not just in urban areas, but also where stuff is being grown and in other places throughout the communities. So one of the ideas, or one of the reasons for the corporation commission first to set up the rules, is to really work with the industry and figure out where makes the best sense to put these facilities in place and how can we ensure the stability for the long term.
Thank you.
So that generates a question for me. I'm sorry, Representative Ruske had his hand up.
Okay.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Evans, so I come from a software development background, and when our team builds software, then we have another team go try and break it. So I see you building something here, so I'm going to try and break it to make sure it works, right?
Good.
And okay. So what if, and this is hypothetical, what if I were to sell other cash products that aren't so legal? And brought that with my legal marijuana sales to this corporation, can I launder my money now?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Ruske, I would assume that you could attempt to launder the money the same way you can now through the banks and credit unions.
Okay.
I mean, I yes, probably.
Okay.
The idea of having the accounting procedure, though, again, having a formal record-keeping process in place that theoretically would be as subpoenaable as any other activity, is at least more than we have right now when it's an all-cash environment. We don't know where that cash is going. And I know that the federal government has certain requirements of $10,000 at a time, et cetera, but $9,999 isn't $10,000. I mean, I think there's no way to ensure that we have a law that will prevent all crime. My concern right now is the 80%, 20% rule. Will it actually do 80% more good than the 20% of harm it may cause? Because right now I just do not like the idea of having something that Oregon can do really well, the federal government not allowing us to do that something that we do really well, and there be small businesses and folks who are literally just doing their job put at higher risk because they're packing around so much cash.
May I add to that?
Yes, please. Yeah.
As far as the money laundering part goes, because there are no ties to other financial institutions, that really wouldn't happen. Money that goes to the depository could have come from other means, other sources, but it just goes there and then it comes back to whoever put it there. That person still has the problem of getting it into a bank for whatever purpose they want to use it. So that would be the check as far as money laundering goes, because right now FinCEN has a set of guidelines that are used to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Thank you for answering my hypothetical question.
Thank you. The conversation you had with Representative Finley raised a question for me. Are we going to have to build a bunch of vaults around the state to do this? I mean, that's what it sounds like you were describing when you said we were going to have offices scattered out in rural areas.
Representative Barnhart and also to Representative Finley. In another state, an enterprising private corporation went out and found several banks that had been formerly banks and decided to use them. So I don't know that we would have to build. I think we would certainly have to secure facilities that had the ability. But ideally, that could be done in a way that uses existing real estate that may not be as used as it originally was purposed.
Thank you. There are a number of vaults like that. I read in the Times of Brownsville, for example, recently, that the Key Bank is being converted to another purpose. I can't remember exactly what that was, but they're planning to leave the vault in place.
Yes, sir.
In that business. Now, Mayor Ware would probably not like me volunteering his town for one of these facilities. On the other hand, the vault is there, and I suspect you're right. There are a lot of places where they had branch banking.
Yes, sir.
That don't anymore.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else for this panel? Thank you so much. We appreciate very much your testimony. Colleagues, when Representative Evans asked for this bill to be heard, he also indicated that he didn't expect it would be ready to move this year, and that's still the case, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Yes, I just appreciate the opportunity.
This is a prelude to what you may be working on in 2019. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4091. Are you ready on 4120?
Sure.
Yeah. And we'll open the work session on House Bill 4120. Colleagues, before I recognize Representative Smith to make some motions, let me explain what we're doing parliamentarily. And that is that last time we adopted the Dash 3 amendment, which set up some specific rules around subpoena powers. What we're contemplating this time is suspending the rules to remove the Dash 3 amendment that we adopted and instead move the Dash 1 amendment, which simply removes the subpoena power in this bill. And I think that's generally understood. Representative Smith?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4120.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4120. Those are the opinion that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4120 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll. And I'm going to, that's what the reading says. Our tradition here is to ask if there's objection. Is there any objection to the motion?
I'm not going to object, but Marsh just got here.
Well, here she comes. Representative, the motion before us is the motion to suspend the rules to allow the reconsideration of the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 4120. And the question I just asked was, does anyone have an objection to the motion to allow that? And with seeing none, it is so ordered. Representative Smith?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we adopted the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4120.
Representative Smith moves that we reconsider the vote by which we adopted the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4120. Is there any discussion? Those are the opinion that the, well, let me ask, is there any objection to the motion to reconsider, essentially remove the Dash 3 amendment from the bill as we considered it in the last work session? No objection, so that is so ordered. Representative Smith, the Dash 1?
Sure. So, Mr. Co-Chair, I'd move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4120.
Representative Smith moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4120. Do you want to explain to us what that amendment does? I think I got it right, but I'd rather have someone else explain it.
So the Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's primarily a one-line amendment. And what it does is on your bill, on page 4, removes the section that talks about the subpoena power for the local government. That's what lines 38
right.
through 43
right. do. Thank you. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Therefore, the motion carries. And the Dash 1 amendment is added to the bill, removing lines 38 through 43 on page 4. So Representative Smith?
Yeah, so with all that said, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 4120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 4120 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, discussion. Yes, Representative Smith, and then I lost whose other hand? Representative Nose, maybe.
Nope.
No, it wasn't Nose.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start off by saying you've been more than gracious in allowing broad conversation to occur on House Bill 4120. I think that's been exceptional, so thank you. I'd also share that there's been a tremendous amount of confusion surrounding this issue in terms of the applicability of how it will play out around the state and who it will impact. I initially was going to be a no on House Bill 4120 with the Dash 3 amendments, but with the acceptance of the Dash 1 amendments, I can now move myself to a yes vote. With that said, I still think there's much work to be done on this issue, and I think there's going to be an opportunity for all parties, if they're willing to come together and get around a table, to find a win that will work for everyone. And so with that said, I will cast a yes vote.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Marsh, please.
Well, first, thank you, Chair. I would like to thank all of you as my colleagues for your patience as we work through in this very short session some of the issues around this particular bill. And I would agree with Rep. Smith that there is more work to do on the transient occupancy tax. Life is changing quickly, and we have to change our systems to adjust to that. But I think this sets a very clear sort of basic message in the delineating the responsibility of who is required to collect these taxes, even as business models shift, and what the taxes should be applied to. So I think it's a good bill.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Reschke, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with my colleagues' comments. I'm just going to be the no probably at the dais here, just to put on the record that it needs more work.
Thank you. May I say, I think that Barnhart's corollary number 436 applies, and that is that any time you start a subject matter, it requires at least three fixes before you get it right. I think this, if I've got it counted correctly, I think this is fix number one. So I'm not at all surprised about the possibility that the bill is not perfect and that the legislature will have to deal with it again. Any other discussion? Thank you. With that, we will call the roll on this. A yes vote is to send the bill to the floor with a do pass recommendation. A no vote is to not do that.
Representative Bueller.
Yes.
Representative Findley.
Yes.
Representative Fernandez.
Yes.
Representative Marsh.
Yes.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Reschke.
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Yes.
Sorry. Chair Barnhart.
Aye. With that, the motion carries. The bill goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Representative Marsh, will you carry?
Certainly.
Thank you. My Representative Marsh will carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 4120. Colleagues, I want to consult with Chris for just a minute, so let's stand at ease. Please do not wander off. What else is ready to move?
That'd be great. I'd love to hear.
And
that's a good idea.
Colleagues, I want to just bring you up to date on where we are. We've passed out 4120 just now. I thought we were going to pass out 4162, but we just received another amendment that's required because there was a piece that got left out that needed to be put back in, as it turns out, which we'll hear from somebody. Who's here on that? We're not ready for him yet, but I will want him later. But what I would like to do is to talk about some of these other bills and see how we're coming on those. I've been told that we really need to get bills out of this committee by Wednesday if we're going to do that. So let's just go down the list and open a work session on House Bill 4027 and talk about where we are today. Colleagues, we've had a number of discussions trying to figure out how to save the solar piece of this bill. We have not been able to figure out how to do it. The most recent effort still misses several of the pieces that we need to consider. And Representative Smith and Representative Findley were the ones who pointed out some of these problems. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but I would love it if you'd explain a little bit about what your concerns are about this piece.
Sure. Do you want to take
Well, I would just share with you, Mr. Chair, there's still confusion in my mind how this request will play out with certain other property tax exemption programs, including the Enterprise Zone program, the Red Zone program, Red Leg program, and the STIP program. And so I'm still trying to get my arms around, is this for smaller solar development, as was shared with me by certain professionals, but having others say, no, that's not necessarily the case. And so I just think there's still outstanding issues on this, and I'm not sure it's ready for prime time.
Thank you. Representative Findley, you've made some comments to me on the floor this morning, and if you're willing to share those, I would love to hear them.
And I appreciate that. I agree with Vice Chair Smith. There's a couple issues. I've had lengthy conversations with with multiple county assessors that have solar arrays, and some concerns come to mind is in some counties that have a special bond election for schools that they would like to see those costs continue on and not be completely forgiven through this exemption process, as well as some special assessment districts. Several counties have vector control or education service district, and they don't know how they will all wrap into that, and they have some grave concerns. Until they can probably get it on a spreadsheet and lay it out, they have a lot of pushback. So I think there's something that we probably need to continue to work at. Like, it's a great work in progress, I believe.
Yeah, thank you. Other discussion comments on this piece? I'll just say that I don't think it's just chaff that's being thrown up. I think these are real substantive issues. This may be fix attempt number one for the bill we passed last time. But at this stage, at least, unless somebody can come up with the amendments that deal with the concern, the valid concerns, I think, that Representative Smith and Representative Finley raised, I think that this is looking more and more like a 19 issue for me. The other pieces on the Housing for Low-Income Rentals, the -3 Amendment, and the Gigabit Amendment that Representative Noses has described to us, the -7s, look to me like they're ready. Any conversation about those pieces? Because I'd like to post this for tomorrow and move it. Okay, no, that's our, Chris, that's your marching order. -3, -7, and no original bill for tomorrow, fiscal if you can get it. All right. So with that, we'll close the public hearing, the work session on House Bill 4027, and we'll carry over House Bill 4027 for working tomorrow. It's already posted. Perfect. All right, let's open the work session on House Bill 4080. This is our update bill, and Kyle is going to talk to us a little bit about it. And I apologize to colleagues for all these work sessions, but I've not been able to figure out any way to deal with the multitude of issues that we have that don't involve giving us a chance to sit and talk about it a little bit. Kyle, do you want to tell us where we are on this one?
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, House Bill 4080, we have the -6 amendment now, and it's up there in OLIS. And the -6, so the underlying bill, again, is making the connection to the federal connection to the Internal Revenue Code, and this is not the rolling reconnect definition of taxable income, but it's the hard connection, so it's changing that date from December 31, 2016 to 2017. So the -6 adds an additional change in that hard date related to ABLE accounts, and that's updating that from December 31st, 2015 to December 31st, 2017. And then the second change in the -6 has to do with what was discussed with the committee before related to the 529 programs, the college savings programs. So just as a reminder, again, in the recent Tax Cut and Jobs Act passed at the federal level, there were changes to 529 programs to allow withdrawals up to $10,000 a year for essentially primary and secondary education, so K-12 education. And the committee heard legislative council had discussion upon Oregon's constitution and how that could potentially conflict with funding for religious institutions and such. The -6 essentially would require an addition to taxable income equal to the amount that's subtracted if an individual or a taxpayer withdraws amounts to use for that K-12 education. So if you continue to withdraw only for higher education, the program would work as normal, but the change here in the -6 is saying if you pull those amounts out to use for K-12 education, you'll add back any subtraction you've previously taken related to the taxes here in Oregon. So Oregon allows a subtraction, and then you'll also add back the expenses, the earnings expenses, or the earnings, if any, the earnings minus expenses, I suppose, any earnings on the account that are not subject to taxation. And of course, that's at the federal level as well, so those would continue to not be taxed by the federal level because Oregon doesn't control that portion, but any of the earnings that are would otherwise be taxed here in Oregon would get added back for those withdrawals for the K-12. So those are the two changes in the -6 related to 529.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I'm understanding this, so in English, that means, in regular English, that means basically if you took it out for high school education, you're going to have to pay taxes on it.
Correct.
That's right.
Okay. In Oregon.
State taxes.
State taxes. Yes.
Right. Let me refer you to page two, I think. At the top of the page, it says, ORS 316.680, there shall be, wrong one. I'm looking at the wrong one.
You're in the bill or the amendment?
I'm looking at the amendment. Where am I?
Keep going down.
Page three. I'm looking at line four on page four, where it says, there shall be added to the federal taxable income, colon. And then there is A, B, C, and so forth, on the way through to K. K is the new item, which is the bolded face language. So you add to federal taxable income for the in your state or income tax return a new item K, which is the one that Kyle referred to.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you have to go to look at two different pages to make that work. Any questions about that? He tells me we don't have the paperwork, so we will hold this over till tomorrow, and it may already be posted again. If there's other discussion about the measure, I'd like to hear it. Representative Rusky, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one clarification is when Treasurer Reed came and talked, he was concerned about us being legal within the 529 structure.
Correct.
This solves that legal problem, or?
We heard from LC that as long as the structure of the plan fit the 529 idea, that it would still work.
Okay.
And of course, it was her opinion that this change would not affect that.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else? All right. So I plan to work this tomorrow with when we get the we get the paperwork in, and. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4080 and open a work session on House Bill 4162. And this is the one that I was hoping to work today, but we have a problem, apparently.
Do we need to wait till 2:15?
Oh, wait a minute. Do we need to wait till 2:15? Ah, thank you. Thank you. We will suspend our work session.
Are we going to be here at 2:15?
We'll probably be in caucus. You know what I better do? We're going to have to hold this over till tomorrow, aren't we? So we'll close the work session on House Bill 4162. Thank you. That's part of the reason I'd be sitting next to me. And Chris, let's carry this one over for work tomorrow, and hopefully you'll figure out what the amendment is and be ready on the paperwork. All right. Now, so with that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 4028, and let's talk a little bit about where we are on those issues. And I'll tell you, let me go down my cheat sheet, and then you can bring us up to date on where we are. I think we're ready on the Dash One Amendment, to House Bill, the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit, that, if you'll recall, Mr. Van Landingham told us that he'd left a piece out, and he wanted to put it back in earlier. We had the film and video change, which had to do with the possibility that the Ways and Means Committee or that the legislature might decide to add funds to in a current fiscal year, fiscal biennium, that in fact, in my view, has virtually no effect in Oregon law, but may affect some other things. Then we have the manure for biofuels credit, which has been rewritten yet again by Representative Smith, and we think that's ready. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Working Family Household and Dependent Care Credit, and that issue had to do with single students with children. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us where we are on that? Mm-hmm. That seems to be the one that's holding this up. Is this ready now? Do we have an amendment that works, or do we need to talk about it some more?
Mr. Chair, we are getting close. We have an amendment, the Dash 6, which is up in OLIS. Okay. There are some technical changes, tightening the language of the policy. The underlying policy will stay the same of trying to expand the credit to both single students and joint filing, so married students. It is a refundable credit, so it's working to expand that credit to students, full-time or part-time students. So that language, the underlying policy is more or less put together, but the language does need to be tightened a bit from what you see in the dash six.
Okay, now did I get my short description of the policy? Is that what you understand the policy is in this amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this has been with working with guidance from Rep. Kenny Geyer, who's the chair of the Housing Committee as well.
Right.
So.
All right. So again, in some senses, this is a technical change because we just left out a population last time when we adopted the bill.
There, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 162 in the previous session, 2017, did part of this. It would begin with this tax year. The language, the way it was written, is a little clunky, for lack of a better word,
okay.
A better term. So this is building on that and then expanding a bit to make sure that the married students are also getting some benefit from this as well.
Gotcha.
So we do expand this. This will be an expansion of the policy. Working on the revenue impact statement now, but this definitely will. It's a little bit more than a tweak, I think it's fair to say, but it is aimed directly at those.
But will we have this tomorrow?
I think Wednesday is a
better
is an absolute. Yes, I think we'll have it by Wednesday.
All right, colleagues. We last time we talked about this, I also indicated that we were going to deal with a request for a tax credit involving brownfields rehabilitation. That is off. The proponents of that have decided that it's not ready, so we don't have to deal with it. Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Is there? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a subsequent referral on this? Does this go
this
to
goes
Ways
to the
and
floor?
Means?
No, this goes to the floor. These are tax credits.
Okay.
This is money that comes out before Ways and Means ever sees it.
And we don't like that.
Ways and Means doesn't like that. I detect one no vote.
This is where we get to act like Ways and Means. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There's a dash eight.
I will acknowledge that the dash eight is the brownfields one, isn't it? No?
No, that's a different policy.
It's something else.
Yeah.
Tell us about the dash
eight.
Okay,
the dash eight came in a little after noon, so I don't actually have in the SMS or the table that's up in OLIS right now, but it's creating a tax credit similar to the film and video where you auction the tax credits and then you use those auction results. The amount coming in from the auction, in this case, for contributions would be used for certified weatherization and retrofit affordability program.
Thank you. This is the one that you were talking about, isn't it? All right. We probably should talk about it now.
I'm going to go down.
No, you can do it right from. I mean, if you want to go down, you can, but you can do it right from there, and explain to us what you're describing and. Why you think it's ready, if it is.
Okay. Thank
this
you, Chair.
This is the dash eight?
The dash eight. The dash eight is posted.
Okay. So, thank you, Chair. So none of you have seen this because it is an amendment that, with the help of a 24-hour-a-day legislative council, we put together this weekend, and very grateful to them for doing that. It became obvious last week that with salt limits that there could be an appetite for more tax credits. And so we put together this amendment, the dash 8 to 4028, to establish a tax credit auction for a maximum of $9 million a year to fund the Home WRAP program. WRAP is an acronym. It stands for Weatherization Retrofit Affordability Program. That's what the amendment to this bill does. But if I may, I'll spend just a minute telling you what the heck the Home WRAP program is.
I think that's a great idea.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So those of you who were here last year will remember that we saw the end of the RETC, or the Residential Energy Tax Credit. And when RETC went away, and when the substitute that we tried to put together at the end of the session was not approved, we spent a good amount of due diligence time at the end of the session really trying to think about what had happened. We were trying to understand what the flaws in the RETC were, what the needs of the industries, that is energy efficiency and renewable industries, were to remain robust and vital. And most importantly, we were really looking at how a program like that could best be structured to serve Oregonians across the state. So after a lot of conversations with people in both government and industry and some outside-the-box thinking, we realized that we could really put together a program that could, in effect, help to address the state's housing crisis through targeted investment aimed at existing housing stock. Clearly, this comes, we come at this from the perspective of the energy efficiency sectors, but we also understand that when we invest in homes and apartments across the state, we can provide energy efficient and affordable homes for years to come, and so that is the intent of the legislation. And HomeWrap, in short, provides a financial incentive to homeowners and nonprofit landlords who install energy efficiency and/or renewable projects on site. The energy is calculated based on the energy saved or produced by the project. Low and moderate income households will get a higher incentive to make those projects more affordable. The bottom line is that we are really looking to establish comfortable homes and reduced utility prices for homeowners and tenants. Projects that qualify for the incentive are pretty constrained. They really have to be able to demonstrate that they have energy efficiency or the ability to produce power. But they would include ductless heat pumps, high-efficiency water heaters, high-efficiency service furnaces, solar installations, community solar, with a maximum incentive available of $4,500, and for solar projects that decreases in future years. Just a couple quick other comments about why I think the program is innovative. First, as a direct financial incentive, not the kind of tax credit that we had with the RETC. The program is going to be much more accessible to lower income individuals and those without a significant tax liability. And we are also going to try to include, as mentioned earlier, nonprofit landlords, which I think is a really important pilot to see, to build a record so that in the future we could actually extend such a credit to for-profit or general landlords. Secondly, the bill provides secondly, the bill directs 25% of program funds to the Oregon Housing and Community Services for critical home repair projects that braid together energy efficiency and critical repairs. We know that this is essential. We need to be doing whole home renovation for people, but very typically in the past we've had weatherization in one bucket and critical repairs in a different bucket, often administered by different governmental entities. This is an attempt within housing to really do a pilot project to show how we can braid those funding streams and really take care of people and extend the life of their homes. So that's an important pilot. Within that pilot, there is also an effort to try to look at manufactured home upgrades and or replacements. So there's a kind of a pilot within the pilot. Mm-hmm. So that's the program. It's been reviewed by Economic Development Committee. It's now pending in Ways and Means. And again, when we saw the potential increased appetite for tax credits, we thought that perhaps that was a, that would be a good way to go to raise funding for the program.
Okay. And you've asked for $9 million
$9 million
a year,
mm-hmm.
and it sunsets in 2024.
Right.
Is there a would there still be an appetite if it sunset earlier than that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, what we are really looking for is a way to fill a gap period of time. RETC ended. We didn't put anything in its place. We know farther down the line that there's going to be some incentives and that the technology is going to get cheaper and more accessible. But for the next probably 4 years, we've got a problem in keeping the industry vital and robust, and that's a big part of our bill, along with actually making investments in people's homes.
Right. And if I understand it correctly, this sets up an auction system similar to the one we have for film and video?
Correct.
So the people who are weatherizing don't get tax credits. They get a grant to help with the weatherization. Somebody else who actually has tax liability buys the tax credits and uses them to reduce their own income, their own income taxes.
Chair Barnhart, yes, that's correct. We found when we really dissected the RETC, we felt like the individual tax credits were really an impediment. That's a difficult program for someone who has lower tax liability, and a direct financial incentive seemed like a better path to make sure that we know what we're actually buying with those dollars.
Now, could a landlord who has leaky apartments take advantage of this kind of a program?
The incentives are open to nonprofit landlords and landlords who have certifiable affordable units, like a housing authority.
HUD HUD certificates, that kind of thing, too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other question, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing this concept forward. I think it's a great idea. Earlier this year, I had a conversation with the general manager of Umatilla Electric Cooperative, who shared with us the need for these type of programs. And one of the things he also shared was in his electrical cooperative district, and I think throughout much of rural eastern Oregon, some of our most senior of seniors and some of our most disabled of disabled live in older single-wide manufactured homes. And what this general manager pointed out to me was that they're paying electric bills of $400, $500, $600 a month.
Wow.
And if we had the ability to put them into a brand new single wide on a 10-year loan term of $200 a month, they're still up $300 a month in the cash that's going out. And I would be interested in knowing if at some point in time we collectively could talk about that concept of, one, including our electric cooperatives in these type of programs, because they're reaching out on a daily basis to their consumers who are also members.
That's
who are members.
Yeah.
So they're not for profit, they're membership driven. But two, look at, is there a way for the owners of these homes to update their residence by purchasing a modern single wide versus the 1968 that they're paying $600 a month electricity for, and saving for $300-$400 a month. Anyway, just a thought, something to add to the conversation. But I think what you're doing makes sense.
Yeah. Other conversation at this point. This is really late, but if this amendment works. Now, let me ask a different question. Does this depend upon the passage of the other bill?
Well, I think the other bill, if those who are viewing the other bill knew that there was a potential source of revenue, might be an encouraging factor. But certainly they need to be able to approve the structure of the program in Ways and Means.
Right.
I'm assuming.
Is this bill then, is this written in such a way that it's contingent upon the passage or the establishment of the other program?
Well, I guess I...
And if it isn't, how would we manage that if this passed and that didn't?
I will have to get some advice, because I haven't, honestly, we just got this off the press. But it does note that it goes, I mean, it certainly names the program as being the recipient of the funding.
Okay. All right, so that's a question that we need to figure out the answer to. And what's the shortest possible... end date for this tax credit that would still allow it to be of some use?
Well, the in the bill in the current form, which didn't anticipate a tax credit auction, we were asking for 4 years.
So four,
we're hoping to roll the program out for 4 years.
4 years would be 2022?
Yeah.
Or would it? 18, 19, 20, 20, it would be 21. End of 21, so beginning of 22,
mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. All right, that's a useful information. I mean, I anticipate that the legislature is going to be in dire straits for funds in 21, 23, and 23, 25. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's what you said basically mm-hmm. at our other hearing last week. So a closer sunset date might actually improve the odds of it being approved. I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Anything else? So we've now added the dash eight. So we have affordable housing lender credit, film and video, manure, working family household, and dependent care, which may or may not happen depending upon whether that can be brought into shape right away, real fast, and weatherization, the dash eight. Anything else? Thank you so much. With that, committee, we're going to close the work session of House Bill 4028. Is that scheduled for tomorrow as well? It is, so I don't need to carry it forward. We're meeting on it anyway. Colleagues, you have time to make a dash to your caucus meeting. The committee is adjourned.